Hi, you're listening to DebtWired. I am Alvaro Ledger, U.S. market reporter at DebtWire's New York office. And in this episode, you will hear from Deepak Puri, Deutsche Bank's private bank chief investment officer for the Americas. We'll discuss the bank's outlook for 2026, both in terms of what to expect from the global and U.S. economy. We will also go through what themes will be different from 2025 and artificial intelligence impact on productivity and growth. Thank you very much for being with us this morning, Deepak. I would like to begin by asking you about Deutsche Bank's expectations for 2026. In the report, it is mentioned that you expect another constructive year given the positive macro environment, albeit with continuing market volatility. What do you expect to be the main volatile themes next year, and what are some of the themes of 2025 that might get left behind?
Great, Alvaro, greetings from me to you and to your listeners. It's great to be with you. So as you mentioned, we just released our 2026 outlook. It's encapsulated in 10 individual themes that covers the economy and various financial assets. I think you are correct in saying that 2026 for us is turning into another constructive year, at least as of the facts of today in middle of December. We expect it to be somewhat of a continuation of what we have seen over the last few months in 2025. Just to give everyone a sense of what we think with regards to macroeconomic backdrop, we expect the global growth to be around 3.1%, which is a very reasonable and healthy clip. But a lot of that growth is coming from the areas that we think are going to be quite important going forward. The first one would be US, where we expect the growth to come at 2.1. And then we see Germany doing a lot better in 2026 versus 2025. There was hardly any growth to speak of in this year, but in 26, we expect that number to be at 1.2. And last but not the least, China to remain as a somewhat of an Asian growth engine and come in at 4.5% GDP growth. So the key takeaway from a growth perspective is that no major country or region is in a recession. And then a lot of this growth is driven by the twin engines of monetary and fiscal policies. A lot of governments are still injecting liquidity into the economy via fiscal programs, be it in the US, we have seen, and I'm sure we're going to talk more about it. But similar trend is happening in Europe. It's happening in Japan with the new prime minister. So there's a lot of fiscal policy momentum. And in addition, you have monetary policy, which means that major central banks, when you think of, they're either on a cutting cycle, and we just saw a Fed cut rates yesterday, or they are in a pause mode, like the ECB. But none of the major central banks, except for maybe BOJ, is on a tightening trajectory. So you have certain very positive monetary and fiscal policy stimulus, which are the key drivers for the growth numbers that I talked about. Now, you mentioned volatile themes, and I think the biggest ones that comes, and here you want to get more specific with regards to the country in question, and I speak mostly about the US. From the US perspective, the AI CapEx spending has been one of the key determinants of relatively good growth numbers that we have seen even in 2025 and what we expect in 2026. This AI CapEx spending is captured in what's called the non-residential fixed asset investment when you look at from a GDP construction perspective. And a lot of the spending that we hear with regards to data centers being built is really a key factor for why this particular number is going up. Along with that, we expect the consumer theme, which is really the key determinant of US growth, to remain quite stable and slightly even uptick compared to 2025. And the reason for that is the actual implementation of the One Big Beautiful Bill, which allows for a lot of tax incentives. So no taxes on overtime, on tips. That should help propel consumer spending. So you have consumers doing reasonably well. Again, the caveat here, I would say, is the labor market statistics, which I'm sure we're going to again discuss. And then the marginal factor that's really impacting, but could be volatile going into 2026, is the AI spending. So far, it's been a key driver. We expect it to be a key driver, but you cannot rule out a couple of setbacks on that front. Now, the second part of your question, what are the things that are being left behind? And I think one key assumption that we are making with regards to our global growth is that the worst of the tariff and trade policies is behind us. Now, we still may hear more about it in 2026, especially bilaterally, but the big shock that was given to the world economy via Liberation Day, that was probably the worst point for the trade and tariff situation, which we think may not come with us going into 2026.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that and the possibility that the tariffs might still be in flux. It seems like they might be, but the initial shock of Liberation Day might not happen again next year. Going back to what you mentioned on artificial intelligence, it does say on the report that Deutsche Bank's outlook is mostly positive when it comes to AI. But what are maybe some of the risks you see related to this new technology, if any?
Well, any new technology like AI, which is considered to be what's called a general purpose technology, right? GPT. Other general purpose technologies would be, think of anything that impacts not a very niche sector in an industry, but it permeates throughout the economy. You could think of integrated chips, you can think of internet, you can think of radio when it was first introduced, or going even further back, railways. These things change not only just how you work in a small sector, but overall economy. So the way you work, you play, you spend money, and so forth. So AI, again, in its infancy, but it's looking like a general purpose technology that's going to have a far-reaching effect for years to come. Now, having said that, the first thing that usually something like a new technology that attracts is a lot of funding, is a lot of investments. And that is precisely what we have seen over the last, I would say now, 3 years, because the advent of this stage of AI is really considered to be the OpenAI ChatGPT introduction in late 2022. So we are almost 3 years into this. But if you were to zoom out, that 3 years might look fairly short period of time. So right now, if you look at where the money is flowing, it's flowing into the infrastructure area of the AI stack. An AI stack is something important for all of us to understand, because it's the stack that is going to really generate the productivity gains and the really upliftment of a lot of countries and companies. The infrastructure is then further categorized into the computing power, which comes via the chips, then the data, for which you need a lot of data centers, and then the energy, because a lot of this requires a tremendous amount of energy. So the first aspect of AI has been that a lot of money has flown into these three components, the energy component, computing component, and data component of the enabling aspect of AI. Now, going forward, we do expect some of the exuberance that we have seen on the infrastructure spending to start coming down, because it just cannot sustain at these levels. You're talking massive $500 trillion worth of investments into this already that has been promised to the markets. Now, going ahead, you're going to start seeing a little bit of a shift from the enablers to the adopters of this new technology. And here, the LLMs, which are the large language models, the more constrained data sets and applications become much more important. So the use cases. And so what you are going to see is a pivot from the bottom of the stack to the more use cases of the stack. And I think that's what is going to be the big difference between 2025 and maybe the next couple of years. That doesn't mean that the infrastructure plays completely out of commission. It just means that it's broadening out. The investment aspect of AI is broadening out. The other question that I get a lot, Alvaro, is related to the comparison of AI to the dot-com era of the late 1990s. And I would say there are certain similarities. This was similar in a way that there was a new technology that was upending a lot of the stuff that companies were doing. However, I would say that things are a bit better and different this time, primarily because the entire industry has been drawn by some big companies. So you may have heard of Mag7 or the big tech in the US, which has done really well. And these companies are established players with multiple sources of revenue. And AI tends to be just one of those multiple sources of revenue. So they are using their free cash flow coming from existing businesses to invest in AI because they feel AI is the place to be for years to come. In the mid to late 1990s, there were companies with relatively very little or no revenue or free cash flow that were generating multi-million, some even billion-dollar valuations. So that is a very big difference. Now, that doesn't mean that everything is fairly priced. Obviously, the Mag 7 and the tech sector seems a little bit more expensive. But even without that, I would say that just look at the fact what happened in the late 1990s. Even after the dot-com burst, the internet didn't go away.
You mentioned growth in the U.S. and specifically mentioned the continuation and introduction of extensive tax relief measures and spending through the big, beautiful bill. Does this also give you any concerns regarding the fiscal trajectory of the U.S.?
Yes, you bring up a very good question and observation, Alvaro, because if there is one risk which does not really have a calendar associated with it, it could be a risk for 2026, it's also probably going to stay with us for some time to come, is the fiscal health of the U.S. We are looking at an economy that has generated a lot of wealth for a lot of individuals and companies, but that has come at a price. And that price has been that there has been a lot of fiscal indiscipline since the pandemic. And I think the focus here should be post-pandemic, because post-pandemic, and under both administrations, Democrats and Republicans, you've seen tremendous amount of liquidity being injected into the economy to fulfill their campaign promises. We have seen the debt really balloon. And now we are looking at an economy which is around $30 trillion, but is carrying a debt of around $38 plus trillion. And a lot of that debt has been accumulated over the last 3 to 4 years. And I think the speed of debt accumulation is really a concern for the, especially the overseas investor, because they may not have the understanding of the nuances of the debt, which I would like to also spend a moment on. But overall, the speed with which we have accumulated the debt and how our debt to GDP numbers look today will give anyone who's lending money to the US government, to the US individuals, would have a little bit of a pause. We still continue to maintain twin deficits, both a trade deficit and a budget deficit. And our budget deficit is really where things get a little bit scary, because we are spending close to $2 trillion more every year than we receive as a government. So that's a lot of money. And a lot of that money is going unproductive, meaning we have to spend interest payments. Because we have accumulated so much debt, we have to pay interest on that debt. So a big chunk of the money that goes into the spending part is not going to new schools or infrastructure or even defense. It's going to pay back the interest on the debt we have accumulated, which is probably the most unproductive part of this. The only silver lining here, if there is a silver lining, is that a lot of countries injected debt into their economies post-pandemic. And US was one of the only economies which grew much better than the rest of the world. So one good thing about this debt injection has been that we have been able to grow very nicely over the last 3-4 years. We have avoided a recession. And I think that's something positive to take away.
The report also forecasts 3 interest rate cuts from the Federal Reserve by the end of 2026. Like you mentioned, they just had one yesterday in which the Fed's chair talked a little bit about the tension that exists right now between the 2 mandates of the Fed. I was just wondering if there are any events that you think might change Deutsche Bank's forecasts regarding Fed rate cuts, and would also like to hear you talk about the possibility of sticky inflation next year, as it is something that a lot of people have been bringing up this year.
That's probably one of the more important things to consider for investors going into 2026. We're talking at a very opportune time because we just had the Fed meeting yesterday, But also, interestingly enough, there was a what's called Summary of Economic Projections release. This is a quarterly exercise that the Fed does where they signal to the market what the committee feels is the most reliable monetary policy trajectory going forward. And here, there are a few things to take away from. The Fed has a dual mandate, which is full employment and price stability. And Jay Powell, in his press conference, made a remark which a lot of us, including myself, would suggest that he's more concerned about the labor market weakness than on inflation. And with regards to labor market weakness, the ongoing assessment is that the numbers that you're hearing from the non-farm payroll report and other anecdotal evidence is probably overshooting the job gains. And once you do the revisions, actually the economy might be actually losing jobs, meaning it's not adding new jobs, it's subtracting jobs from the economy. So that makes job cut a much easier way to deal with it, because that's an insurance rate cut. You are preemptively cutting interest rates so that you can give a signal to the markets that economic conditions and financial conditions are going to be smoother and softening, and you should start hiring. Now, on the inflation front, Jay Powell also mentioned that he feels that the tariff-induced goods inflation, that has been what's been the sticky part of inflation, and that should start to come down in the first quarter of next year. So that was also somewhat of a positive take that inflation, yes, it's at an elevated level. And by the way, it depends a lot on what inflation gauge you're looking at. So CPI is very different than PCE. The Fed looks at what's called PCE, personal consumption expenditure. And our assessment is that core PCE number should come down to 2.4% by end of next year. And I think that is very similar to what the Fed is trying to suggest as well, that yes, it's sticky, it's around 2.8, 2.9% over the last few months, but it should start to gradually go down to the 2% target that the Fed has. That's the Fed's comfort zone. So taking all those remarks, the market feels a little bit relieved that yes, the Fed is much more vigilant on expanding the growth rather than being very tight and not cutting rates. And I think that was a good thing. The other two things I'll mention is, one, there's a lot more dissent today in the Fed than there has been, meaning that there are certain voting members who would rather see a 50 basis point rate cut. And then there are certain voting members who would not see anything done to the rates. They would rather stay on a pause. And then the second thing is that there is a little bit of a concern with regards to Fed independence. There was a Fed governor, Lisa Cook, who was asked to resign. When she did not resign, she was quote-unquote fired. But that decision now sits with the Supreme Court. And on January 21st, we are going to get the decision around that time frame from the Supreme Court. So the Fed is an apolitical party, and hopefully it remains. But there are other non-monetary policy things that are also clouding some of the Fed yardstick going forward. So I think those would be the key points related to the Fed. We expect two more rate cuts from now till the end of 2026.
I would like to ask you about something that the report mentioned, which is that higher expected default rates are expected in the high yield space. And I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit more on that, because the overall tone of the report is positive in terms of growth in the U.S. I was wondering where the higher expected default rate is coming from.
You want to distinguish between index level default rates versus sector slash industry related rates. And I think here what we are talking about is that if you think of global monetary policy easing, that actually is a positive for companies to avoid bankruptcy, because the financing is a bit cheaper. Interest rates have come down. So that's generally net positive for the index level. What we are trying to articulate in that statement is that there are certain sectors, both in the US and Europe, and these were the two main regions where we do some analysis, where there could be some concerns with regard to higher default rates. And what do I mean by higher default rates? You're looking at around 4%. Of default rates on an index level. But the three areas that we are cautioning investors to avoid would be A, media and entertainment, especially traditional media. Secondly would be energy. And then third would be retail and consumer related areas. And these three have some structural and some tactical headwinds that I think makes it a bit more vulnerable to higher default rates going forward. The spreads are also very tight, right? So you're looking at a high yield market where the spreads are historic lows. It has limited cushion for any stress if growth slows. So our base case is for growth to do well, is for economy to do well. But if there's a sort of a deceleration at any point, and that could happen for a whole host of reasons, the spreads are so tight that with limited cushion, you could see a little bit of a heightened concerns with regard to the credit conditions. So overall, it's not that we are severely underweight or we are asking investors to shun the high yield space. All we are saying is that from a risk-adjusted basis, and each individual's ability to stomach that risk is going to be different. You may want to compare high yield with other parts of the fixed income, maybe investment grade, and see on a risk-adjusted basis which area makes more sense for your portfolio.
Deepak, anything else you would like to bring up from the report that you don't feel we really touched on?
Yeah, very just quickly, thanks for giving me this opportunity, Alvar. It's been a pleasure sharing our views for 2026 with you. One thing that I would mention is that on the equity front, you don't want to be overly bearish at this instance. I understand we have had three very strong years, 23, 24, and then now 25 also. It seems like we're going to end the year with a double-digit return. Just because we've had such strong returns does not mean that the market is going to now flip. A lot of times, investors get very nervous with regards to the way the market has been rallying. All I will say is that the macro conditions being very conducive to risk and the earnings from the companies seeing a broadening out effect. It's not just a big tech play. Other companies are doing well. I would be very concerned about trying to time the market. Having said that, you do want to be a little bit sensitive with regards to your return expectations. Stock markets generally don't give you a 16-18% return year in, year out. If you were to zoom out over the last 100 years, it falls anywhere between 10-11%. So have a little bit more realistic assumptions from the stock market. But overall, we continue to believe that this is a good time to be invested. A well-diversified portfolio. And please take a look at overseas investors' investments as well, Europe and Japan in particular, because those areas are going through a fundamental shift from a fiscal policy perspective. Sorry, so we are taking a little bit extra time here, given you gave me that opportunity. But that's about it from my side. Back to you, Alvaro.
Thank you so much for that deep dive. I'm sure our listeners appreciated it. Thank you again for being our guest today. Thank you to our listeners for always tuning in. If you have missed any episodes, you can find all of the DebtWire episodes on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. We hope to see you all again on the next episode, and bye for now.